A podcast of the cinema.
My name is Dave White.
And I'm Alonzo Duralde.
And your job is that you are the film reviews editor of The Wrap.
That's correct.
Also, you're a talking man.
On yes, that's my official title.
On What the Flick.
Yes.
I just wanted to throw that back in your face because early on in our relationship, you said to me one day, "You're a talking man, ain't you?"
You know where I got that, right?
I can't remember.
It's from an old American Splendor strip where they refer to people as either being a walking man or a talking man. And you are a talking man.
Yes, or you.
I know.
So
that's why we are married to each other.
That was a nice way of putting that information.
Wasn't it?
That's by way of introduction.
Yes.
We're two film critics who are married to each other. I write for The Wrap. You didn't say that.
Well, I didn't get to you. Yeah. You threw me off.
I'm one of many film critics for The Wrap. You're the film critic for The Wrap, plus the reviews editor.
I'm the reviews editor.
You're the one that gets your name in its own special link.
It's true.
Yeah.
So I am a category.
You're the critic of The Wrap, and the rest of us are just your little satellites.
Hardly.
We're late. It's
yes.
It's Monday.
Sorry, everybody.
We normally record this on Sunday, but yesterday was a full day. You had a bunch of friends over to dye Easter eggs.
Yes.
That's a very important tradition.
Anything I like to do on Palm Sunday.
In this house. We'll talk about most of that on...
Linoleum Knife and Fork.
Linoleum Knife and Fork.
A podcast of the food.
Yeah. Which you can get...
By joining our club...
You join our club, you subscribe via Patreon, patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Yes.
And that'll tell you everything you need to know, the amount of money that you are going to have to give us, and all the things you're going to get.
So many things.
So, there's that. Meanwhile, while you were dying Easter eggs, I went to the opera. Here's the thing I didn't know about my opera yesterday.
You didn't know Hoffman had that many tails?
I didn't know how many tails he had. Well, no, I did know he had three. There were three tails. Mm-hmm. And there was an epilogue, act one, act two, act three.
Prologue, you mean.
Sorry, prologue, act one, act two, act three, epilogue.
Can it, Hoffman?
And the three acts each were a tail.
Right. Good thing you weren't at the Decameron.
I didn't know that this one was like 3 hours and 10 minutes plus intermission. Mm. It's like little two 15-minute intermissions. I was at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion all day.
Yeah.
I had the big idea that I was going to go down after the opera and take a picture of the Tony steps.
Oh, right.
I mean, I did that once before a long time ago, but,
yes. You
know, Instagram has never seen the Tony steps.
That's true.
And so,
if you've seen Valley of the Dolls, we're talking about the steps by the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, where Tony Pilar slips and Sharon Tate memorably utters "Tony."
Yeah.
So the Tony steps.
It's quite a moment in the film, and every time I'm at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, I like to walk up and down the Tony steps.
Of course.
Because that's Sharon Tate was there once.
Yes, it's Hollywood history.
So, But it was so late that I didn't get to do it. I mean, I was like, I felt like I had to run home
because
we were planning to do the podcast.
Yeah. But I'd been entertaining all day and you'd been sitting in a squeezy opera seat for 5 hours.
Yeah.
So.
It was a long day.
So we didn't, and we're sorry for that we're late this week.
We're sorry for a lot of things.
It is. It's
right now.
But it's a packed week, and we're not even getting to all the things that we could be getting to.
Well, there are...
This week and next week, there's just a shower of indies.
Here are the films that are opening that we're going to cover.
Yes.
They're the films that opened this past Friday. It's now Monday.
Yes.
Friday the 7th?
Yes.
Yes. The assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Your name.
Mm-hmm. No, we're not doing your name.
Hang on. I'm just saying what opened.
Oh, okay.
The assignment, your name, the case for Christ, Smurfs, something.
Lost Village.
Going in Style, Colossal, Their Finest, Graduation, and Truman. We are not today. We are not going to cover your name because they sent me a screening link that failed.
Yes.
I started watching it, and 10 minutes in, it crapped out on me. Just froze up. Nothing I could do. So I'm going to go buy a ticket this week, and I'm going to watch it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Which, you know, I like doing that anyway. I don't like it. God, I really hate the screening links that you have to watch on your laptop.
I don't mind a screener link that I can send to the Apple TV if it's like a Vimeo or something.
Yeah.
But if it's some funky, like, it's our intra, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no, that's what half of them are. Yeah.
Always crash.
I am not seeing The Case for Christ, period. I'm not.
I told people this on the Facebook page.
Ain't doing it. I know that y'all like it when I go. People who listen regularly understand my background with extremely conservative evangelical Christianity.
Right.
That's how I grew up.
From your ute.
And because of that, I'm obsessed with the current wave of Christian filmmaking. Almost all of it, absolute garbage.
I actually encountered a thread on Facebook in which they were talking about faith-based films.
Yes.
And someone quoted you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they quoted your thing about how it's because they got rid of all the artists.
Yeah.
Anybody who asks
questions. Who was it that quoted me, and where was this thread?
I want to say it was Jesse Whitehead. It was some other film person on Facebook was talking about, because of Case for Christ, they had linked to some article, or they had some discussion about faith-based cinema and why it stinks, and somebody said, well, Dave White nailed it pretty well by saying that. I think it was Jesse.
I sure did. But you know what? I'm having a moment, and I've been having this moment since last fall.
Yeah.
Where I'm fed up. I'm fed up with movie after movie from Christian filmmakers being not just garbage, but smug garbage. Mm-hmm. And happy in its own ineptitude and happy with its own lack of Christian principle.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's terrifically bad films. The one that came out this week, The Case for Christ, apparently is getting some decent reviews.
Yeah.
I'm confused by that, and part of me now wants to go see it to figure out what the hell people are talking about.
I suspect the bar having been lowered probably helps.
Because this is a film about apologetics, a subject we've discussed on the phone.
On the show.
A subject we've discussed on the show before, which is...
This,
honestly, it's a clever parlor game where you
work backwards to prove a thing you've already decided.
You
is
reason
true.
you attempt to reason your way into faith, which
the case
is
for,
not
the case for Christ good. Is a memoir written by the guy who plays himself in God's Not Dead 2.
Yes,
so yes. I'm already not interested.
You know what? I may get over my fed upitude and go see it, but as of right now, no.
If you go, I'll go with you.
Okay.
Whither that goes.
We're going to hold Graduation and Truman for next week. Because the only big movie opening next week is Fate of the Furious.
Right.
And then there's a couple more indies opening next week. The new Terrence Davis movie.
Opens in New York.
A Quiet Passion opens in New York.
Get this. It opens in New York, Boston, and Amherst.
Of course. Yeah.
Because it's about Emily Dickinson.
Yes. And then the week after it opens in Los Angeles, which so we might even wait till the Los Angeles opening
we'll see.
To get it because I want you to see it.
Yes.
You Alonzo Duralde.
Right.
I have seen it and I will tell y'all in advance, it is magnificent.
Oh, right. For me to see it projected, we'll have to wait for the 14th. You're
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Yes. I know they sent you a screening link.
And you were like, no.
See earlier conversation that we just had.
No, but even when links work, like, you do not want me to see this particular
no,
movie.
No, even if this one worked impeccably, I don't want you watching this on the TV.
Yeah, because Terrence Davis is, you know...
Unless you have to. Like, if you have to see it at home on streaming video or on DVD or whatever, I get it. But if you don't have to,
yeah,
you go. You go see a Terrence Davis movie on a screen.
Yeah.
You pay respect to that man's
cinematography.
Yeah. And then I saw the Japanese film After the Storm this week, but I'll be waiting until next week to talk about that.
Oh, okay.
Just because there's just too much.
Yes.
This week we are going to talk about The Assignment. We are going to talk about Smurfs, What's It's What's, Going in Style, Colossal, and Their Finest.
Yes.
That is what we're going to talk about today.
And that's plenty.
But we're going to start by taking a step back to last week's show.
Oh, yes.
People are mad at me, Alonzo.
A listener who was a...
More than one.
Who was a great supporter of the program.
Yeah, more than one listener, but yeah, one...
is vexed with us.
A listener spoke to me in public. A couple others spoke to me in private. None of them are happy. And when I it was about the things I said about Ghost in the Shell.
Yes.
Here's what I said. That I didn't hate it. I said that it is racist. It gets all the race stuff wrong. It even tries to have its cake and eat it too by letting you know that the character that Scarlett Johansson plays is in fact Japanese.
On the inside.
On the inside. And they have put her into this
Scarlett Johansson
robo body. And after they tell you that that's what happened to her, they don't tell you what that means or why. They drop their own ball. They drop their own possible, plausible way out of the whitewashing controversy.
Yeah, they could have said something like, you know, we wanted to make sure that no one would think it was her, so we made her a different ethnicity. And that's why we did it, not for any other reason. Yeah, then there's no effort to make it a plausible plot point.
Right. None. Zero amounts of effort to do that. And then I said the following. But it looks so cool. I'm so happy about how cool it looks. And you should go see it because it looks so cool. And pay extra money for the 3D. Because the 3D is beautiful. Now, I'm a film critic. And if a film has something terrifically offensive about it, and yet there are other qualities in the film that makes it, you know, something of interest that maybe you'll want to still watch if you are like a film student, you're, you know, a film history student, you want to know, you want to see the thing, you know. You want to see Birth of a Nation because it's reprehensible and it's part of history and you...
And they invented the close-up.
And you want to see it for that reason.
We watched Olympia for the editing of the diving sequence
when
I took a film class, even though it's a super Nazi propaganda movie.
So that is the burden, the specific burden of being a film critic.
Yes.
Now, but that's not the point here.
Okay.
The point is... that I went back and I listened. Because when I first heard, when people first came to me and said, you screwed up. I thought, I did? What? Oh, no, no, no. No, not me. For I am woke.
Hashtag woke even.
I thought, no, this can't be true. I can't have made this colossal of a mistake. And so I went back and listened.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, yeah, I'm an idiot. Yeah, I completely screwed up. Because to hear me talk about Ghost in the Shell last week, it's this. Yeah, I mean, it's racist and stuff, but it looks great. So the tone of voice that even I was using was weighted toward, oh, just blow off the racism and go see it because it's pretty. I did that.
Okay.
And I am wrong. I'm wrong.
So moving forward.
No. I have so much more to say about this. Okay. I'm not even ready to move forward yet.
Okay. Stew in this. Or as Tony Tripoli would say, sit in it, bitch.
I am not just a film critic, but I am white. Now, being queer and a film critic positions me in a somewhat different place than if I were just a heterosexual white cisgender film critic. But I'm still white. And when you are white, you live in a world that is guided, that is ruled, that is dominated, that is ordered by white supremacy. You just do. And because you are white, you not only benefit from that system, but you fail often to see what that system is doing. If you are white, it is inevitable that you will screw up. And when you do screw up, it is incumbent upon you to say, oh, I did. I will do better. And that is what you must do. You must listen to the people who are telling you that you screwed up. See what they're saying about how you screwed up. See if they're right. They're not always going to be right, but quite often they're going to be right. These people who talked to me last week, they're right. In film, I think you and I, when you and I watch a film, as conscientious, queer, white film critics, okay, you and I are attuned to seeing things from that outside perspective. In spite of the fact that we're white, we're still used to seeing things from that outsider perspective.
Sure.
And I think that perspective, that queer, place that you and I come from, makes it a little easier for us to see problems in film as they relate to race, to gender, to misogyny, to anti-queerness. When it comes to race, though, when I think about race in film and I think about the problems, of race in film, I think about films that have white saviors, and you and I are pretty good at spotting those and calling them out.
Right.
Tokenism, same thing. You and I are pretty good at spotting that and toking and calling it out. We do not toke.
No.
But here's the thing that happens in Ghost in the Shell. The thing that happens in Ghost in the Shell is erasure.
Yes.
And that's the hardest thing to call out, because so often it's the one type of racism that very, very frequently presents itself as nothing.
Benign.
Well, not just benign, but as something you don't even see. It's not even there. You have to say, why is the thing not there?
Right.
You know? The thing I should be looking for, the thing everyone should be looking for, why is the thing not there?
It's the invisible elephant in the room.
But Ghost in the Shell, and here's why I'm still not off the hook, Ghost in the Shell announced its erasure and then screwed up explaining it.
Mm, yes.
Okay. So, we're about to talk about The Assignment, which made both of us furious.
Right.
In the same way that Ghost in the Shell made our dear friend Jen Yamato furious.
Yes.
And you guys, go read the stuff she has been writing this week.
Her conversation with Justin Chang in the LA Times.
Not just the people who came to me and told me I was wrong, but the stuff Jen has been writing. All the stuff I read by Jen this week has made me think, I'm being stupid. I'm being stupid and white. That's the level of stupid I'm being this week about this film.
Here's the question I have, and I agree with everything you just said, and I think you're right that we do have to pay more attention, especially about stuff that isn't that doesn't fall under our own personal purview.
Yes.
How do you differentiate between a politically reprehensible and yet aesthetically interesting film like Ghost in the Shell, as opposed to a politically and aesthetically reprehensible film like The Assignment? It's very easy to slough off the latter because it's a total failure. But this other movie is there's something, you know.
The visuals are still really beautiful in Ghost in the Shell. And to that I would say, if you still feel like you need to see this film because you want to experience that. Last week I said, go buy a ticket and pay extra for the 3D. Mm-hmm. This week I'll say, go buy a ticket to something else. Sneak in to Ghost in the Shell. I'm not opposed to sneaking into things that are bad.
Right.
Buy a ticket to something else. Sneak into Ghost in the Shell if you must see it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and if people are against me saying see it for this or that reason anyway, then we're just going to disagree about that.
Yes.
Okay.
A movie's politics doesn't necessarily...
They don't annul other positive qualities.
Yes.
They do make those positive qualities a deep problem to get over.
Yes.
You know, or rather, they do make those other qualities something that must be approached after getting over the other big problem.
Right.
That's what I meant to say. I got it backwards. Anyway, it was only after the fact, only after listening to us again, that I realized that my comments were weighted way heavily on the side of seeing it for the visuals.
Okay.
That is not what I want to be out there. Obviously, that podcast is going to live out in the world, and I hope people come to this one too and hear my retraction. Is that the right word?
Clarification.
I guess, okay, clarification. I mean, I do not believe as a film critic that it is my job to take a position and hold on to it like cement forever.
Right.
I believe that my opening statements as a film critic are either the things I write about the film or the words I speak about the film on this podcast. And that is the beginning of a conversation.
Yeah.
And a year from now, I might think that the Emily Dickinson movie A Quiet Passion is flawed somehow. I won't think that because it's a Terrence Davis movie. No. I need, and everyone needs, every film critic needs, especially these know-it-all ones that are out there, and they know who they are. Your mind's going to change, and sometimes it's your readers and your listeners who are out there paying attention to you because they like you, because they like reading you, they like listening to you, they sometimes agree with you, maybe they never agree with you, but they still want to read you anyway. They're the ones who are out there saying, hey, you forgot to mention, or you didn't say this, or you did say this, and you're a fool. And it's your job, unless that person is a complete idiot, and you know when they're complete idiots and when they're not. It's your job to listen.
Yeah.
And to rethink positions sometimes.
No, constantly. I mean, both in the sense of just the art itself, and then in the larger issues of, you know, representation. I mean,
yes.
I have said stuff on this show about trans people that was a reflection of what I knew at the time.
Yes.
And I know more now than I knew then. And I will know more 5 years from now than I do now.
Yeah.
You know, I think this stuff is always an ongoing conversation. That's why it drives me crazy. The people who obsess about the numbers on What the Flick.
Yeah.
And they'll literally be like, you gave Star Wars a this, and then you gave this movie a that. And it's like, oh my God, I made up that number in the moment.
Right.
I'm not married to it forever. And well, and it's all relative anyway, so shut up.
So if you want to say this is me backing down, I see it differently. This is me being told I'm wrong and me realizing, yeah, I was wrong.
Fair enough.
What I said was stupid. I'm glad people told me that it was stupid. I want to state for the record that I am unequivocally opposed to films that get race and gender and misogyny and queerness wrong. That's that. I will say one more thing. Because we are film critics, you and me, and we see so many damn movies, doesn't it often feel like something like Ghost in the Shell or even The Assignment, you know, or Get Hard, or name it, just a rotten movie that got something terribly wrong. Any of the Katherine Heigl romantic comedies.
Chips.
Doesn't it seem like after a while, when your job is to just keep watching, that it all feels just like ongoing disappointment instead of a moment to like really rally the troops for something, to call something reprehensible? You know what I mean?
Yeah, like you feel
like it feels like it's just washing over you. You're like, oh well, there they go again.
Yeah, you said you.
Oh, start, good. Ghost in the Shell cast Scarlett Johansson and then didn't bother to explain why in the course of the narrative. Okay, well there they go again.
You start to worry, like you start to worry that you're becoming the film critic who cried wolf, even though there's always a wolf.
There's always a wolf. Yes, and so there's a moment in your life, in your job as a film critic, where you think, okay, they're just doing it again. How? Should I? Do I yell about this one? Do I yell about the next one? Does this weigh heavier than the other one that I did yell about or did not yell about? Sometimes you forget to weigh it properly.
Yeah.
However, that's our job.
We'll do better.
It is my job. I will do better. Well, you know what? In listening to the show again, you came off all right. It was me. It was me. I'm Goofus, you're Gallant.
In this one instance, maybe.
Yeah. So,
shall we talk about
the assignment? See you in hell, Ghost in the Shell.
Shall we talk about the assignment?
Oh, let's get into it.
Yes.
Let's do it, the assignment. Okay, first of all, F this movie.
Oh, my God.
Why don't you
two times?
Why don't you explain? Why don't you explain the plot?
Okay.
It is a script from the 70s.
It is.
That Walter Hill, the great director, Walter Hill,
and the guy who wrote Turk 182.
They've been sitting on this script since the 1970s.
For 40 years.
And there's a lot of dust on it.
Oh, yeah.
You think there was dust on that mint? Dust on this script.
We open in an asylum where psychiatrist Tony Shalhoub is there to interview brilliant surgeon Sigourney Weaver in a straitjacket.
That's right.
Because she has been declared too mentally incompetent to face trial, and he's trying to find out if that's still the case. She tells him a story that no one believes about a hitman named Frank, played by Michelle Rodriguez. Yes, that's right. A hitman played by Michelle Rodriguez.
Do you want to, before you go on, do you want to talk about the prosthetic life of her, of him? Sorry.
I was going to get right there. Yes. Okay. So Frank has a beard. Frank has a hairy chest. Frank has a dong that is made of something.
It's a big swinging one too.
Yeah.
He walks across the screen and it's going ka-dunk, ka-dunk, ka-dunk,
ka-dunk. So we see all this in grisly.
It's some Boogie Nights level.
Fakery.
Wang, yeah.
Terrible. So we see all this in grisly close-up. And Sigourney Weaver hates Frank because Frank killed the only person that Sigourney Weaver ever liked, which was her brother, who was a total scumbag. So now Sigourney Weaver's sworn revenge, and that involves getting gangster Anthony LaPaglia to hire Frank, but really it's a trap. And then Frank wakes up in a seedy hotel room 2 weeks later, and what?
Boy, oy, 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 oy. Yeah.
Frank is now Michelle Rodriguez. And apparently Sigourney Weaver is such a brilliant surgeon that when the bandages come off, there's not a scab or a stitch or anything.
No scarring.
And Michelle can shake her hair out and be on the cover of Vogue.
Yeah.
There's a tape recording from the doctor saying, you know, I've given you a second chance on life. Leave the violence behind and go live as a woman. But Frank is still Frank, and Frank vows revenge, and things get violent and bloody and stupid.
How stupid does it get, Alonzo?
This movie lacks such a fundamental understanding. I mean, okay, let's just talk about the trans part.
Okay.
The mechanics,
yes,
of gender surgery, chosen or otherwise, in this case, enforced, yes, the way the film portrays it.
Yeah.
But has no clue how long things take.
No.
What the multiple processes involved in doing so. It's just this sort of cheap gimmick of like, waka waka, you're a woman now. And it has no understanding of any of that stuff. And it is portrayed in this like really tacky, exploitative fashion.
Yes.
In a world where trans people are currently like facing constant discrimination and...
In a
non-movie
world. Okay, clear.
Sorry, this movie exists in a real world where trans people are discriminated against and attacked and murdered all the time.
Yeah.
But no...
Daily violence, daily, you know, attacks on their lives.
Yes. But their experience is now turned into this ridiculous...
Real cool sci-fi gimmick.
Stupid thriller.
Yeah.
Okay. Taking that out of the equation, we are then still left.
Okay, do we have to take it out of the equation?
No.
Can I keep going a little bit?
Please, have at it.
The film actually goes very near the end, because they better have put something in it.
Yeah.
Where Sigourney Weaver very near the end says, "And I learned that gender isn't about the genitalia. It's in the mind."
Thanks, Walter Hill.
I swear to God, someone made them add that line. They looped in something.
Get 80 yard later.
It was a reshoot, something. Someone came to them and said, you guys have really screwed up. You effing idiots. You nearly 100-year-old man.
And now they can win a GLAAD award.
Yeah. 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 And that one line is supposed to absolve the entire film that comes before it, that at every opportunity treats this situation like a wacky freak show and has zero understanding and zero inclination to understand what it is that is happening to this character.
What we are told about Sigourney Weaver's character is that she has done like cheap sort of back alley gender confirmation surgeries.
Uh-huh.
And also that she has performed horrible experiments on homeless people, which are never explained. So we, in the context...
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you for just a minute. And those two types of surgeries that she's performing are so muddled in their... The explanations of them are so muddled that they go back and forth in talking about everything she does as experimental surgery.
Exactly.
And this, again, means that this film exists in a non, you know, movie world, in a real world, where there's absolutely nothing experimental about gender confirmation surgery. Nothing.
It's an established thing.
Yeah, no one's saying, we must do this dangerous experimental surgery to make you a lady. Like, it's not, that isn't real.
Right, but I'm just saying, because...
But the movie doesn't even understand that.
The movie doesn't understand that, and the movie is so vague about what it is she does and what she's done in the past that's so terrible that we're left to feel like that the essence of what she does to the Michelle Rodriguez character is in itself a terrible thing when it's just... It's a thing that was done without permission, but the thing itself is just a surgery. It's a thing that happens. This movie. But as opposed to what we were saying with Ghost in the Shell, where it's like you have on the one hand racism, on the other hand like art direction. You know,
right?
This movie is all rotten all the way through.
Yeah, as filmmaking, it is bad filmmaking.
Yes.
The story itself, as it exists in time, makes no sense.
Right.
Because three different moments during the running time, a Chiron appears at the bottom of the screen that says 18 months earlier, 22 months earlier, 2 years earlier. And you don't know...
Earlier than now?
Earlier than now or earlier than the last time it told you it was earlier. Like, it has no idea how it exists in time.
Yes.
And it is absolutely confusing as a story.
And it does this stupid thing where it does these comic booky scene transitions, like we're not supposed to be taking this as seriously or something.
Yeah, no, that, again, I guarantee you, put in late.
Probably so. But apparently, Walter Hill went back and did that to the Warriors as well. There's like a really director's cut out there with that stuff.
Yeah.
So he has this fixation with the comic book thing that never works, apparently.
Well, that comic book framing was totally meant to...
Distance.
To give them an out and say, well, no, this is just science fiction fantasy weirdness. Ha ha. We didn't mean it. There is... Unfortunately, a generation of people who will never understand queerness of whatever, stripe.
Right.
And they're the people who say things to you and me. And, I mean, come on. They're the people who say things to you and me like, so which one's the woman? Who's the wife?
We don't get that one so much anymore.
We have gotten that question.
Absolutely.
That literal, actual question.
Yes.
And it happened within the past 20 years.
Yes.
That question. So, there's a whole world of folks out there who... Not only who aren't even enlightened enough to ask those kinds of stupid questions. They already think they know enough. Right. And they just go off and do their thing. And when you tell them, they say, oh, I thought I knew enough. And then they don't care that they don't know enough.
Oh, no.
Because Hill himself... has been in some interviews recently where he's saying, oh, no, this is, this movie isn't...
It's not intended to reflect the trans experience, but we get the psychology right because Frank, remains Frank.
And like, right.
Yeah, bully for you, Walter Hill. What's been driving me...
Great director or not, what's been driving you crazy?
What's been driving me crazy is straight dude film bros who have used this movie as an excuse to remind everybody how great Walter Hill is.
Was.
And exactly.
Was.
And like they're...
I have not seen any recent evidence.
I love our friends at the American Cinematheque, but like this is the movie they decided they're going to do like retrospective screenings of The Driver and The Warriors on. It's like, where was all this Walter Hill love when Supernova came out?
Right.
Or Bullet in the Head.
Yeah.
No, this crap-ass movie, suddenly all the straight guys are having to come to his defense.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, yes, Walter Hill, great American auteur, blah, 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 blah. And if I see one more review that talks about how this movie is refreshingly free of political correctness, I'm going to punch somebody in the face.
Always replace the words political correctness when you see them with the words basic human civil rights and decency.
Yeah, dignity.
And see how it sounds then. Because that's what they mean.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they mean. In defense of American Cinematheque, I bet they planned this before they even saw this movie.
Could be.
I bet they planned this retrospective before they even saw what this film was. That's my guess. I'm guessing that's what they did. But, oh my. Now, should you see it? If you're a student of queer film studies, yep, you should, because it is loathsome, and the people associated with it ought to be ashamed of themselves. Yes. And
on a historical level, it is on a trajectory
of
people getting LGBT stuff totally howlingly wrong. However, if you are asking, is this a movie I should go see because it's so bad it's good?
No.
No.
No, it's so bad it's bad.
On the Dave White scale, it is not a movies.com zero star.
Because that's the groovy bad movie.
It is a movies.com half a star.
That's a half a star.
Which is crud.
Because half a star is just pathetic. And this movie is pathetic.
Yeah, I gave it a zero at Metacritic just to make a statement, but
yeah.
It's not even that. It's not so terrible you have to see it. It's just terrible.
Yeah. I think about this film, I think about Get Hard, you know. And if you never saw Louis Vertel, point blank ask Will Ferrell
and Kevin Hart. What the hell they were thinking.
He does it at a film junket, no less, where you're not supposed to ask questions like that.
Yeah.
You're supposed to ask easy softball questions, and he just didn't. You ever seen that clip? Go look it up. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Watch them squirm.
We had him on the show right after that.
Yeah.
To talk about that movie.
Should you see Partners? Should you see Windows? Should you see
The Detective,
The Fox?
Staircase.
Oh, God. Should you see Staircase? Yeah, you should. I've never seen a movie like Staircase in my life because I've never seen a queer-themed film that made me feel that sick to my stomach about the misery of those characters.
Yeah.
Utterly
full of loathing.
You know, let's go back to Ghost in the Shell. Should you see a film like Mandingo?
I once TiVo'd off of TCM, Tea House of the August Moon.
Yeah.
A film about Chinese people starring Katharine Hepburn.
And who else?
Walter Pigeon and like Aline McMahon and like all these incredibly white people.
Yeah. You know, should you see these kinds of films? I'm going to continue with, yes, you should see them.
To know that this happened.
To have a record in your own mind. It hasn't always been awesome.
Yeah.
It's not awesome right now. But if you think it is, it hasn't always even been this awesome.
How many Judy Garland movies did you see where she performs in blackface? Like three?
A good three or four.
Eesh.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this is part of a shameful history of the movies of getting this stuff wrong. Does that mean you should go buy a ticket right now?
No.
But like eventually.
But here's the great thing. This movie is playing like art houses.
I think it's day and date. Like it's streaming somewhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I think it'll be on a limited release.
Yeah. Don't pay to see it streaming. If it's playing in your town, go buy a ticket to something else.
Or just wait for a cable or Netflix or something where they don't pocket as much. But
right.
Yeah. I mean, see this thing for the horror of it, but don't support it.
Yeah. do we want to keep going negative? Let's do that.
Sure.
You saw Going in Style. I did not.
Oh, that's right. You didn't.
And I'm not gonna because of what you said. I asked you because I did somehow, some way see the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And the trailer makes it look like it's one of those 70s kind of stick it to the man kind of movies where you root for them because the system has screwed these old people.
Mm-hmm.
Capitalism needs to be killed. and they're about to go rob banks and kill it. To that, I say, set it off.
There's
but you're telling me that it's not that sort of rousing?
There's a tiny bit of that. It is part of the plot that they are driven to rob a bank because their company... They're all steel workers who live in Brooklyn, which I'm not quite sure...
How?
I don't know where that major industry
they
was
were
taking
steel
class.
Workers?
Yes, they're all retired steel workers living in Brooklyn.
Okay, maybe they all lived in Pittsburgh and now they all live in Brooklyn?
They make it sound like they've lived there for, like, forever. So
was there a steel mill
in Queens? I have no idea.
There might have been.
Anyway.
We don't know.
Anyway.
Okay.
The company, you know, like, closes down, sends all the jobs to Vietnam, and, like, sinks the pension into paying off their corporate debt. So it screws over these guys.
And to give their CEOs raises, probably,
no doubt,
too.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, that is part of the plot. It mainly is just sort of wacky hijinks, you know.
All right.
I mean, it's not as political as, like, the original Fun with Dick and Jane. I'll put it that way. This is a remake of the 1979 caper movie with George Burns, Art Carney, and Lee Strasberg, who really just were bored. Like, that's why they wanted to rob a bank.
I think that's still a good reason.
And in this one, I was bored. It's just so generically hacky. You've got Michael Caine and Morgan Freeman and Alan Arkin, and they're basically playing exactly who you think they're going to play. And Anne Margaret is there to play basically her same role from Grumpy Old Men.
Right.
Which is, and she's essentially a plot device to let us know that at least one of these guys has junk that works. and that's it. Like, she gets Zippo'd her due. And yeah, it's just it's the kind of movie where you can't hate it because it's competent enough, but it's never funny or smart or clever. It just ambles along inoffensively and uninterestingly. Zach Braff directed it.
What else did he direct? That
Garden State, and Wish You Were Here, I think, was the second film he did. The one about, like, Jewish intellectuals or whatever.
Okay.
I've not seen either of those two, but I saw this one, and it's just, it is a big lukewarm cup of whatever.
Good performances?
Again, it's you know what they're all going to do. You know Alan Arkin's going to be cranky, and Morgan Freeman's going to be kindly, and Michael Caine loses his temper occasionally.
Right.
Also, Michael Caine is a retired steel worker in Brooklyn, and nobody explains the accent.
Listen, my...
I'm not going to bury another Batman.
She was just 14
years old. You were only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. Trip to Spain opening in August. I can't wait.
All right.
Yeah, it's there's nothing there.
You also saw The Smurfs, whatever.
Smurfs the Lost Village.
Smurfs the Lost Village.
A much more interesting movie than Going in Style.
Okay. But I saw the first two or three. How many have there been?
There were two.
I've seen the first two Smurfs movies.
Yes, and they were dreadful.
I did not despise them as inoffensive, innocuous children's films.
I thought they were kind of gross. This one,
you tell me about this one, because this one now comes after my 2015 departure from movies.com, which means I don't have to see it ever.
There's no reason that you would need to.
All right, well, I'm not gonna.
But I liked it far more than I liked either of the two previous ones. This one, there's no live action. There's no Neil Patrick Harris gadding about New York. This is all animated.
Yeah.
And basically, it's, you know, the Smurfs live in Smurf Village, and they've all got an adjective. You know, they're all, it's you know, Vanity Smurf and Brainy Smurf and Clumsy Smurf.
So Vanity Smurf is in the movie?
Briefly.
Who voices Vanity Smurf?
He's got like two lines. I don't remember.
No, that's not good.
You know, there's also Paranoid.
My favorite Smurf.
There's Paranoid Smurf and Nosy Smurf and Table Eating Smurf. Like they get it goes deep.
Table Eating Smurf.
Table Eating Smurf, and all it does is hang off the end of a table, and it's about like. it's a goofy joke.
Are you trying to make me want to see this movie?
That's on you.
Table Eating Smurf.
There is a Table Eating Smurf.
Vanity Smurf used to be my favorite Smurf. Now it's Table Eating Smurf. And I haven't even seen Table Eating Smurf in action.
But Smurfette doesn't have an adjective. And she doesn't know what her purpose in life is. And of right. course, there's that whole thing about how she's not really a Smurf because Gargamel created her out of clay. And then she got nice and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I don't even remember what the... Oh, okay. So one day in the woods, she and Clumsy and Brawny or Muscle, I forget what his name is, and Brainy Clumsy and the Strong One find a taupe Smurf hat. And, you know, they all wear white. So they kind of... it's their first clue that there are other Smurfs somewhere out there. So they go through this, like, wall, and they find this lost village, and... Once they're on the other side of the wall, like, things get kind of interestingly, not surreal, but kind of old Max Fleischer-y. Like, you know, the dragonflies are dragons, you know.
All right.
There's these eyeballs, you know, that are on stems, you know, that are plants that dance around. And aggressive flowers and just goofy stuff like that. And they wind up finding the lost village of Smurfs. And it turns out that in this lost village, they're all female.
Okay.
So Smurfette, who for years has been this sort of like objectified, you know, blonde, wears high heels, but has no other real purpose in the Smurf universe, is now part of a sisterhood. And these are like sort of warrior Amazon Smurfs, you know, including Michelle Rodriguez, of course.
So she should just stay.
Well.
Yeah.
Anyway, then things happen from there. I'm not going to give it away. But it's actually...
just go ahead and give it away.
Okay, fine.
I mean, I'm sorry. Are you five? If you're five, stop listening.
So, basically, Gargamel follows them, and at one point he captures everybody, and she gives her life to save both villages' worth of Smurfs. And there's a long chunk of the film where she has been returned back to being a blob of clay... And it's, like, really sad. And I'm like,
okay.
Yes, I love a kid's movie that's sad. And there's a lot...
Okay, now, when you say it's sad, is it...
There's, like, a funeral procession.
On a scale from... saying goodbye to Mac at the end of Mac and Me... to Snoopy Come Home, the most devastating children's film ever created...
Mm-hmm.
What's the number? And one is Mac and Me, and 10 is Snoopy Come Home. How sad is
this? I'd say it's about a 6.
Really?
Like, there's a good 5 or 10 minutes where Smurfette is dead, dead, dead.
Okay.
And there is, like, there's a funeral procession and a whole thing.
I love it when... I like a movie for kids that talks about death.
Yes, and then...
Remember Bridge to Terabithia?
Yes. People mock me for this, but I will bring it up again. Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium is a great kids movie about death.
I know.
Anyway, eventually, yes, the Smurfs bring her back to life, and she is now a full-on Smurf. And it turns out that not having an adjective means that she can be anything and all the things and many things at once.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh my God, this movie actually is about something, and it vindicates this female character who's been set dressing for decades.
Right.
And, you know, it's written by two women, and it... I was just kind of surprised that I was entertained by it, and it actually was thoughtful. So yeah, it's pretty good. But you don't need to see it. But if you're a parent and you're thinking, oh God, not a Smurfs movie, you'd right. actually maybe like this one. They don't ever do the joke where they just substitute Smurf for any verb, noun, or adjective. So
I'm disappointed. In that, I think that's a good. I think that's a good thing.
It was done so many times
in the Smurf first, universe. I'm into it.
It was done so many times in the first two movies that giving that a rest, I think, was a good idea.
Fine.
Also, they don't do the irritating theme song.
Okay.
All good things. All
right.
And you know, Papa Smurf is Mandy Patinkin, and the matriarch Smurf is Julia Roberts.
Mandy Patinkin sure is Papa Smurf. Yeah. I was trying to explain Mandy Patinkin and Yentl to someone a couple weeks ago, and they were like, what? Mandy Patinkin, the old guy in Homeland? I go, go watch Yentl.
Naked, young Mandy Patinkin, dripping wet.
Not to objectify someone.
Oh, come on.
But holy cow, I'm totally objectifying
and
him.
And that movie is totally objectifying
yeah,
him.
Yeah, no, it is.
Babs can hardly keep her eyes off of him. And who can blame her?
Okay, so now we are going to talk about... are you done talking about this one?
I am done.
Shall we move on?
Let's.
Colossal.
Yes.
All right.
Which Gary Cotti did not care for.
I don't care what he says. Gary Cotti's just Gary Cotti is just a friend and neighbor of ours.
Gary Cotti is our Kramer.
He's better than that, I'd say. Okay.
He built the table on which this
he built
podcast
this table.
Currently
yeah.
rests.
He did build this table. This is a film in which someone goes home to their hometown after...
To get their life together.
To get their life together. I hate a movie like that. This one kind of turns that...
trope.
That trope on its ear.
Yeah.
Anne Hathaway is a total mess. You can tell she's a total mess because her wig is a disaster. It is one of the quibbles I have with this film.
Her bangs are like another character.
Every time I saw a close-up of her head, I thought, they needed to budget a little more for the wig because the wig looks like a wig. It's not as bad as Maggie Grace's wig in...
The Choice.
The Choice. Is that what that was? The Choice? Was that the name of the movie? The Choice?
I was not taken out of it by the hair.
The wig took me out. Anyway, her wig is bad. And she's an alcoholic.
Yes.
Her boyfriend, played by Dan Stevens, mm-hmm. he kicks her out of their New York apartment, and he says, beat it. I'm done with you. You're constantly drunk. You've not tried to get a new job. You're
a hot mess.
You're a hot mess. You're a writer who hasn't written anything in forever, and no one wants to work with you because you're drunk all the time. Go. I've had enough. So she goes home to her hometown. Her deceased parents have left her their house. And it just sort of sits there, that
empty,
house.
Yeah.
Empty. So she goes to this empty house and she runs into, a townie that she has known since childhood, played by Jason Sudeikis. He never left. He inherited his father's bar. He now owns the bar. And over the course of the film, you come to learn that he too is a functioning alcoholic. Okay. So you've got a movie that is about alcoholism. It is also a movie about giant monsters fighting each other in Korea.
Yes, it is.
Here's how that happens. Anne Hathaway comes to learn that when she gets drunk and...
No, she doesn't have to get drunk.
When she gets drunk and winds up, you know, asleep on the ground in the park or stumbling around in the park... All night long. At a certain time of the morning, a giant monster appears in Korea and stomps on Seoul, and people die. And she comes to realize that this is happening when she watches the monster's actions.
She starts doing specific motions to see if the monster does
well. She sees the actions of the monster and she realizes that they are the actions that she herself
right.
has been doing. So then she starts intentionally doing things to see if the monster mimics her, and it does. Her relationship with Sudeikis becomes a situation in which another monster shows up, a giant robot, and begins to battle the Anne Hathaway monster. Every time they are drunk or fighting or doing anything in this park at a specific time of day, the monsters appear. That's all I'm going to say about what happens. But Anne Hathaway has to figure out a way to extricate herself from the situation that she's gotten herself into with her alcoholism, the situation she's gotten herself into with Jason Sudeikis, and her responsibilities as the monster. I will not tell you how it ends, but I will tell you this. I feel like, I think that the monster angle of this film is resolved in a pretty clever way, but not the human angle. And because the thing that impresses me the most about this movie is that it gets the idea of the consequences of alcoholism just right on a metaphorical level. It gets the feelings just right. I speak from experience because I grew up with alcoholics all around me. And when you're Korea in that situation, you know what's happening in this movie. Intuitively, in your gut. My gut was tense in this film because I knew what they were doing and I knew the danger that could be coming. I wanted the human element of this film to resolve its storyline more thoughtfully than it did. But I did not dislike the film overall. I think it's worth seeing.
Totally.
Because it's unusual.
Yeah, and I think that it maintains the metaphor far better than you would expect.
Yes.
And so, yeah, strangely enough, it does the hard stuff really well, but the stuff that should be relatively easy, it kind of bobbles a little bit, but not so much that it soured me on the rest of the film. It has a great final line.
It does. there is, you know, if you, like me, grew up with this sort of situation, or if you grew up in an abusive home, because there is an element, there's a plot line that involves actual, you know, an abusive
relationship.
You know yourself. Know yourself before you go. You know, it might make you upset. It very well could.
But in spite of the fact that it's
kind of a comedy. And again, yes, that does mean it's doing its job.
It is kind of a comedy, and I think it actually straddles genres very successfully in that it's funny and it's also kind of bleak at times, and it's a kaiju movie. It's pretty fascinating.
The kaiju themselves are kind of the weak link.
They're a little bargain.
The digital design of the monsters is acceptable.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, not amazing. What else we got?
Their finest.
We saved the best for last.
Yes, sirree, Bob.
Talk about it.
Okay. This is a new film from Lona Scherfig, who is not my favorite director before now. I liked a lot of An Education, but I thought it kind of fell apart, and I really, really super hated One Day, starring Anne Hathaway. So I did not go into this with giant expectations, and I love this movie.
Me too.
It stars one of my favorite actresses right now, Gemma Arterton, or as we call her in this house, Felicity Jones with talent.
That's what you call her. I'm fine with Felicity Jones. She doesn't, you know, wow me. But Gemma Arterton is better.
It's leagues beyond.
Okay.
She plays an advertising copywriter in 1940 London. And In the same way that all the men being away to war means that women are working in factories for the first time, for Arderton's character, it means that she is now going to be a scriptwriter. She is hired by the Ministry of Information to write female dialogue for propaganda films, which her writing collaborator, Sam Claflin, dismissively refers to the women's dialogue as the slop. And so they're trying to figure out what this, you know, what the next movie is going to be about, something that's going to really, you know, rally the morale. She finds a newspaper clipping about these twin sisters who piloted their father's boat to Dunkirk, to the Battle of Dunkirk, and brought home all these soldiers. So when she goes and visits them, the story's not quite that exciting. Like, these two sisters are these odd little homebound women in their late 30s, and the boat broke down halfway there, and they got towed back, and the boat that was towing them was overflowing with soldiers, so some of them wound up on the deck of their ship. And nonetheless, this is the propaganda ministry, so, you know, they completely make it the most heroic version of this as possible.
Yes.
And the Brits are trying to get the Americans involved in the war effort, so they make them create this American character in the movie who's played by this war hero who's played by Jake Lacy, who is super photogenic and cannot act a lick.
And his bad acting is...
His bad acting is brilliant.
Quite delightful, yeah.
Like, you have to be as good an actor as Jake Lacy to do this kind of bad acting on screen. Bill Nighy plays this sort of aging matinee idol who is cast as the uncle who's originally comedy relief, but his role changes. Like, everything keeps changing over the course of the film to accommodate various vagaries of production. And the fact that, you know, like, it's 1940 London, the Blitz is happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's bombing and there's people dying in the streets and just, like, it's a horror show and they're trying to get this movie made. You know, and so much of it is about Arderton's character kind of coming into her own and discovering her, you know, her talents and her abilities and being taken seriously for them. But it's just also about, like, what it was like to be there in that moment. I mean, I've seen a lot of movies that are sort of set during the Blitz, but this one really drove home the horror of it in a way that I hadn't really seen in a lot of British films. I mean, like, corpses in the street, rubble kind of horror,
yeah.
You know? Yeah, I like this a lot. It was based on an acclaimed British novel called Their Finest Hour and a Half, which is a way better title.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
And but yeah, so I super highly recommend this movie. It's funny and it made me cry, and it's a movie about movie making that is, on the one hand, kind of like, oh wow, isn't this amazing, and also like, oh, isn't this all kind of ridiculous, and aren't we all a bunch of egos, you know, grappling for our one moment of whatever. I just adore it.
I saw the trailer for this a couple months ago,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, no, no, no. We were all so brave.
Yeah, it mocks that kind of movie and is that kind of movie at the same time, which is really tough to pull off.
Really hard to pull off, and it does it really well. But you came home from the press screening and said, I loved it. You have to go. Gemma Arterton is completely winning through this film. And her character does things that you might question her reactions to certain tragic events sometimes makes you think, wait, why is she not reacting so strongly? Why is she not reacting as strongly as I would? Well, and then you think, wait a second, it's England in the 40s. And that is a country of folks who were raised to be reserved.
Yes.
And there's one particular tragedy that happens in the third act that eventually does pay itself off in the most lump in the throat kind of way, where you, when it happened, I, in the theater, I think I let out an audible, oh, and it is so sweet and so moving. And you're right. It does gently mock the We Were So Brave kind of film, while at the same time being a film like that and having a a quiet sense of humor about itself.
Yes.
Everybody in there's some big name people in this. Jeremy Irons.
Yeah, Eddie Marzan, Richard E. Grant.
And they're all just doing their part. No one is upstaging anyone else. Bill Nighy is playing the ham that Bill Nighy loves to play. Physically, as a movie, when we finally see the movie that they have made,
yes,
they mimic 1945 Technicolor. 1940 Technicolor so awesomely.
That sort of greenish.
Yeah. It's just. That first shot of the movie, when you're watching it, you're like, oh!
That's exactly what it would look
like. That's what it would look like. Yeah. Bring your mom and your grandma to see this. They will love it. They will love you. this is such a sweet and such a charming and moving film.
Yeah. I totally caught me by surprise. I loved it.
I almost didn't believe you. Because sometimes you steer me wrong. You're like, oh, it was great. I'm like, it wasn't that great. But no, you did. Thank you, husband.
You're welcome.
For steering me in the right direction. I brought my old-timey British movie going pal to see this.
The ladies in lavender were out in full force.
Yeah. Like, this is the dude I take my friend Chris. I take my friend Chris to see things like the Howard Zendry issue and Ladies in Lavender. Like, if it's set in the past in England, we're going to have a breakfast date and we're going to go on a matinee. Because that's the only way you're supposed to see films like this.
A nice cup of tea and sit down.
Then you're supposed to go have some tea. You just are.
Morris reissue in June.
Hell yeah.
Can't wait. 4K.
Yeah. That's going to be a two cup of tea day. I have not a DVD pick. I have something else that everybody needs to go look at.
Okay.
So here's what happened.
Yes.
Do you know about Le Cinema Club?
I don't know that I do.
Well, why aren't you watching your Facebook? Because our pal Manola Dargis posted about it.
Oh, yeah. I posted that on the Linoleum page.
Oh, you did?
Yes. Okay. The Chris Marker and Sparta thing. Yeah, that's already on our Linoleum page.
Well, I want to talk about it.
Okay.
LeCinemaClub.com. L-E Cinema Club. Mm-hmm. They post a free film every Sunday for 1 week.
Huh.
And you can go to the site and watch that film for free. On their site.
What else have they had in the past?
I do not know. This is my first time I've heard about it, thanks to Manola Dargis.
Gotcha.
But Agnes Varda, over the course of a few years, made a short film about Chris Marker, and it is called In Chris Marker's Studio. And they were friends for a long time before Chris Marker died. But, you know, he made La Jetée and Saint Soleil and, you know, dozens of other things. Legendary experimental filmmaker. And Agnes Varda in her own winning style. Agnes Varda, who's 88 years old this year, by the way, she made this film in 2011, 2012, about just going to his studio and sort of poking around and looking at all his stuff the way she does.
Yes.
Her recent documentaries have all been like,
What's this?
Oh, look at that. Isn't that lovely? Well, that's so interesting. I'm going to the trash dump and I'm going to look at things.
Exactly.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
If you've never seen
The Gleaners and I.
Gleaners. You should.
We've still never seen the follow-up.
Magnificent film. So, Go to lecinemaclub.com.
Okay.
And watch this short film by Anya Sawada about Chris Marker.
All right. I was thinking about wartime propaganda aimed at women after seeing Their Finest. And so I thought my recommendation this week would be a classic film called Since You Went Away, starring Claudette Colbert as the mother of daughters Jennifer Jones and Shirley Temple, and about their efforts to sort of keep up the home front while father is away at war. And it is a movie that really kind of puts you through the ringer, but at the same time, it really champions the day-to-day life of what it was like to be back at home in the U.S. during the war and just dealing with, you know, food rationing and air raid drills and scrap drives and you know, women going to work and, you know, not hearing from the soldier for a while and wondering what's happened. And it's quite lovely and a really powerful film that holds up. So that's my pick.
Well, all right.
We have a backlog of letters.
We sure do.
I'm going to be leaving town for the USA Film Festival in Dallas at the end of the month. So we're going to pre-tape an all-letter episode before I go. So we were not going to do any this time.
We'll catch that up. There's just too many things coming out
to
deal with that right now. Hey, do you want to buy a linoleum knife t-shirt?
You should.
You should buy one. They are $22 more if you live in a faraway, not United States country. You can email us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Let us know where you are and we'll tell you how much it'll cost.
And what your size is. The shirt itself is a beautiful black shirt. And the words linoleum knife in big, bright, white letters across your power chest.
Confuse and confound people everywhere. And who knows? Or even run into fellow listeners. You never know. If you live in the U.S., you can just PayPal us directly at, again, linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. It's $22 and tell us where you want it sent and what size you want. We have ladies' sizes and gents' sizes and all the sizes.
Yep.
Thank you all for listening. As always, check out our friends on the internet. Go to christylemire.com, check out the Rotten Tomatoes podcast, listen to the B-Movies podcast and Cancel Too Soon from Bibbs & Whitney. I'm in the middle of their The Master episode on Cancel Too Soon, which you will know better as Master Ninja from Mystery Science Theater.
Yes.
Check out The Schmoes Know and Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Joelle Ryan Thing, The Sewers of Paris, The Comics Canon, Fat Guys of the Movies, Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes. And thank you to everyone who has left us a review. It does help people find the show. If you haven't, please take a second and go do that. We would really appreciate it. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, which includes Stitcher Radio and Podbean and CastBox several other ones. We are at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And again, you can join our club at patreon.com/linoleumknife, where you can listen to our extra episodes of shows like LKTV, Linoleum Knife and Fork, and Linoleum Nights. All the information is there on our Patreon page. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com, and we will be back next week with a whole bunch more movies.
One giant one and six other not giant ones that you'll also probably want to see.
Absolutely. So thanks for listening.
Goodbye.